You're listening to the Heavenly Chi podcast, episode number 86. Today we're joined by Andrea Murphy, a women's health practitioner with over a decade of experience supporting women through every hormonal life stage, from fertility and postpartum to perimenopause and beyond. Andrea has a special interest in the often overlooked overlap between postpartum depletion, early perimenopause, and hormonal burnout in women over 35. Known for her calm and compassionate approach, Andrea helps women feel at home in their bodies again by translating complex hormonal experiences into clear, grounded, and supportive care. So today, we'll be talking all about the ins and outs of postpartum care for women over 35, why recovery at this stage of life feels different, why quote-unquote normal bloods often miss the mark, and what really helps women rebuild from hormonal burnout. Andrea, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Jack and Claire.
Thanks for being here. I'm excited for this chat. This is a topic of passion for me as well.
Awesome. And that really translates because you were who I saw when I was early in my postpartum. So that's where this journey really began for me too.
Yeah. You know, I think it's such a common misconception that women have when they're in their first pregnancy, that there's so much thought put into and so much concern and worry around labor and what's labor going to be like and, you know, am I going to be able to have my birth plan go as expected? There's so much thought put into that one day and there's so little conversation and preparation that goes into that postpartum period. And so many women find themselves really shocked at how difficult that period is. What are some of the things that you're noticing in your patients, Andrea? Like what sparked this interest for you? Obviously your own experience, but I'm keen to hear more.
Yes, my own experience for sure. And then what I see clinically as well in women who are giving birth over 35 is that they say to me, I'm just not coping as well as I could. I just don't feel like I can handle things as I once could. So they maybe report things like an increase in anxiety, trouble sleeping, and just generally feeling overwhelmed and burnt out a lot easier than they did in their formative years.
And why do you think that's so different in women over 35?
I think it really leans on the fact that over 35, we start to see that shift of lower progesterone and just a lot more sort of stress being put on our adrenal glands. So for women over 35, you know, that first sort of early stages of perimenopause, our progesterone starts to decline. And so we might see a shift in mood. We might notice cycles get a little bit shorter, periods get a little bit heavier, but that sort of initial shift of progesterone and maybe even slightly low estrogen can definitely play a role. And then when you put that on the context of postpartum, a lot of that's already part of the picture, especially after you give birth and you have that first huge hormonal drop in estrogen and progesterone to that of a menopausal woman. And then we put on that too, the fact that over 35, we're in that 7-year cycle where those yang ming channels are really declining and we're seeing that natural decline of yin in blood. So that buffer and that nice little sort of filter that we had to the outside world is starting to thin a little bit. Things feel a lot more raw and a lot more sharp and harder to recover from.
Yeah, that was definitely my experience as well. Both of my children, I had them after I was 35, and yeah, the recovery can be really quite brutal. And I see that in some of my patients, and I wonder how much of the, you know, the 35 plus that symptom exacerbation that we're seeing. I mean, especially in my patient demographic, it might be different in your clinic, but so many of my patients who are having children in their late 30s and in their early 40s, they're career women. You know, they've spent 10, 15 years building their career, often working, you know, quite long hours, working working really hard, and they're coming into pregnancy already in a state of depletion. And I wonder how different it would be if, you know, if we were more often working with women who had lived a more moderate life, shall we say, that potentially they hadn't been, you know, that they hadn't been pursuing that corporate dream and the, you know, the modern woman and all of the trimmings that come with that. Is that something that you're noticing? Do you have that? Is that the typical patient demographic for you in that over 35s?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think for me personally, that really hits the nail right on the head as well. But yes, absolutely. A lot of the women who I see over 35 who are having children later in life, often they've delayed conception and trying to conceive strictly for career reasons. And sometimes because, you know, they've taken a little while to find a partner that they want to have children with. But I would say at the top of the reasons why women are delaying having children would be definitely career related. So, you know, I do see a lot of women who are coming in who are business owners, or they are high up in their corporate careers where they're often needing to go back to work quite quickly, maybe due to the fact that they have a small business that they're running, or perhaps they need to get back into their role for whatever reason. But they're needing to kind of expedite the process of postpartum and get back into it. Even before they're back in the office, they're writing emails, they're taking calls, they're, you know, their responsibilities are extended outside of the home.
Yeah. And so then I guess we move into that, the fallacy of the 6-week recovery period, get your mum body back, or some, you know, those types of slogans.
The bounce back rhetoric that we hear so much about. And then, you know, you add on top of that a lot of societal pressures, and that we don't get a lot of maternity leave, and a lot of businesses don't cover maternity leave for women for very long, or in cases where you are a sole trader, you're often having to manage those costs yourself. So for some women, they have no choice. They have to get back to work earlier than their body would need them to otherwise be.
And it's not something that's necessarily balanced with paid paternity leave, for example. There's still the physiological recovery that needs to happen regardless of who is the primary caregiver, whether the father is staying at home to care for the baby whilst mum goes back to work. There's still a really significant physiological recovery, and in some cases some, you know, mental and emotional recovery as well, especially if there's been a traumatic birth experience.
Absolutely. I think that really hits the nail on the head there. And I think as well, a lot of women who are 35 plus, so as we talked about, the initial decline in progesterone in that early menopause, that can really affect mood. And if if a woman's had a traumatic birth, and then she's also already, perhaps even before she conceived, having some early signs of perimenopause, then mood issues can absolutely play a role here. We might see an increase of postpartum anxiety and depression. That's something that I've kind of dug into to see if there's much research out there, because I really want to understand that more. But from what I've discovered, there's more research needed, of course. As we know with women's health, there's, you know, more research to be done in a lot of different areas.
Well, and mental health in general is very poorly researched and very poorly understood from a mainstream medicine perspective. A lot of the treatments are not as effective as we would like them to be. You know, the typical antidepressant, anti-anxiety medication, they just don't necessarily leave women feeling fully supported with their mental health, especially in that postpartum phase.
Absolutely. It's just not a holistic intervention. And it's really interesting, like when I was starting to break all this information down and gather everything together, you know, I wanted to know, I'm like, how many women in Australia does this account for? So what I found out is that 27% of women in Australia are over 35 when they become mothers. And that's a 10% jump from 2020. when it was 17%. And in the 90s, it was only 5% of women. So 27% is very significant. So I think that really calls for a huge change in how we're handling postnatal care. We really need a more integrative approach and to be understanding what women in this demographic might be going through in a variety of different systems and ways.
That's a really significant percentage. I wasn't imagining it would be so high. And I wonder, what are your thoughts on the terminology geriatric pregnancy?
I don't love it. I really don't love it. And I just don't think it applies. And I just want to say something about my personal experience when it comes to geriatric and that term being thrown around. When I was going in for my prenatal care and even into my postnatal care, I look quite young. That's just what genetics gave me. I have a baby face. And so the words and the expression geriatric pregnancy was never mentioned to me. No one ever said that. And I really think that it was largely due to the fact of how I look. You know, I'm a petite woman with a young looking face. So no one said anything like that to me at any stage. And then when I was going through my postnatal care and I was describing these feelings of, you know, postnatal anxiety and all of these other challenges that I started to face around the 6 month mark, in my head, I was like, is this perimenopause? And when I discussed it with my doctors, they were like, no way, no way, that's not you at all. And then the further and further I got with it and the more that I dug into it, I was like, oh no, this is the early perimenopause. And I was probably already in early perimenopause when I conceived my daughter. But because visually I look the way I look, it was just never something that my doctors grabbed onto. And it was really something that I had to push to get anyone to listen to me about. And I wonder how many women maybe experience something similarly, and how, you know, that term geriatric pregnancy is just the wrong kind of descriptive term here. I think there's too much nuance and too much variability between women for that to be applied to everyone.
Yeah. And I wonder how much that term is just something that is kept internally in the mind of the obstetrician or the midwives or the, you know, the mainstream care providers, and whether that's just a lens that they filter things through. I think I only heard the term once across both of my pregnancies, and I was 36 when my daughter was born, and I was 40, a month away from turning 40 when my son was born. But, you know, I had a great relationship with my obstetrician, and any time that he would say something in that kind of postcode, I would scoff almost and just say, you know, like it was always around discussion of risk, which is, you know, for a lot of women can be very anxiety inducing. And, you know, they would talk about my age, but not using the term geriatric pregnancy, but they would say, well, your age and this, the risks are this. And, yeah, I didn't find it helpful to be referring to me based on my age. I always brought it back to, well, what are the actual health markers? This is not about how old I am. This is about my health markers on an individual level. Let's talk about that and let's look at that, rather than, you know, just pile in all of these demographic equations which aren't necessarily relevant at that individual level.
Absolutely. And if we're going to label someone a geriatric pregnancy, what does that mean for their postpartum time? What does that mean for them then? It's sort of like once the baby's born, all of these risk factors and things, it's like, okay, that's done. Great. The baby's out. See you later. After 6 weeks, you're on your own. We're not really, it seems like practitioners aren't really looking at what follows for women over the age of 35.
And I think it's really tricky as well for women to access care in the way that they would like to in that postpartum phase, because all of a sudden they've got this little person who requires hours a day of care and attention, and it's just so much harder to squeeze appointments in and to be able to prioritize self-care. It's something that I think is a real challenge, because there's so many there's so much support that women need in that first, really in that first 12 months, if not 2 years, where that full cycle of recovery, that's how long it takes. It's not a 6-week thing. It takes a long time. I think there's some interesting research, and I can't cite it, but I do recall research around bone mineral density in the mother taking anywhere from 12 months to 2 years for bone remineralization to occur. I think some of that is exacerbated by dietary calcium deficiency for most people, but it's really quite distressing if you think about the sacrifice on a woman's health during pregnancy and with that lack of care and supportive care afterwards. And then, you know, often in the 35 and older cohort, if they're wanting to have a second child, there's usually a really short gap because there's that pressure to have, you know, if they want to have 2 or 3 or 4 children, they really feel that race against the clock. It's hard to balance that. How do you navigate that with your patients?
Well, I really emphasize preconception between pregnancies and giving themselves like a full year to recover. And often that can be difficult, especially when women are wanting to get into IVF again, or because they're close to 40, they think they're running out of time. And so they want to get right into trying to conceive again when their bodies really need that extra time to recover and to rebuild, and not to come into another pregnancy where they're already drawing on their deeper resources of Jing. So I really try to emphasize at least a year's recovery. That doesn't always go over very well. But we really in that time try to do everything we can to get them to where they need to be. And interestingly enough, apart from herbs and acupuncture and some targeted supplements, it comes down to a lot of lifestyle factors and how they're looked after at home, how they're supported at home, and who is there to help with the mental load and who is there to help them find that time and that self-care for themselves. Because if they're not getting that, then it's definitely going to come to bite them in the bum later on with subsequent pregnancies and subsequent postpartum.
I'd love it if you could elaborate on that a little bit, Andrea. Like, what are the specific, I mean, I'll refer to it as Yang Sheng, but like, what are those specific lifestyle practices and things that you recommend for people? Is there anything dietary on top of like the supplementation and herbs? Like, what are you, I guess, especially considering how hard it can be for new mothers to find the time to come into the clinic, how do you get that support into their home for them?
Yeah. So, you know, first things first, no skipping meals. I think postpartum is rife with skipping meals and living on toast and tea. So foundationally, nutrition is so important. Having a very nutrient dense diet, getting enough protein, getting enough fiber, getting enough fats. I'm always explaining about how like protein and fat are like the logs on a fire. They're going to give you that extended energy and blood sugar stabilization for the entire day. Whereas your carbs are like your kindling, right? They're going to give you that quick and energy, but you're going to have those big dips in energy throughout the day. So foundationally, nutrition is very important. We want to get the woman replete with all of her minerals and nutrients that she'll need to carry into her next pregnancy. So foundationally, nutrition absolutely at the forefront of my mind. And then from like a Yang Sheng perspective or like a lifestyle perspective, I give them my energy pie analogy. So I really love my energy pie analogy. Imagine your energy as a pie chart. There's only ever 100% of you to go around, and each slice of the pie is some output in your life. So that could be, you know, chores, family time, sleep would take up a slice, exercise, and so on. Your pie, everyone's pie will look a little bit different. And in that pie, we need a slice for rest and recharge where there is no outputs, that is our time to recharge our batteries. And of course, you know, postpartum can be a busy time, especially if you've got other children or you're back to work. So we really need to ensure that that rest slice is going to be suitable and things will distribute differently. So often what I'll see is women really spreading themselves thin, and I'll ask them, I'll give them the energy pie analogy, and I'll say to them, how big is your rest slice? And they say, oh, well, I sleep, you know, 8 hours a night with a couple of wake ups. And I'm like, no. Rest is rest. Rest is not sleep. So what are we doing to rest where there's no outputs? Maybe we have a moment away from the children where we can just quietly read a book or meditate or just put our feet up and relax and stare at a window and drink a cup of tea. And oftentimes the rest slice is less than 5% of the entire pie. And I kind of have to explain, in order to get the rest slice bigger and to what you need it to be for healing, you need to redistribute your pie, which means you need to take away from something else. So that might be work, that might be chores, that might mean delegating to someone else in your family so that that rest slice can be bigger. So that's a very big foundational piece for my postpartum mothers, especially over 35. That's, I think, applicable to everybody. But I find that to be really important, is that we're getting that time to recharge and not to have so many outputs. Apart from the energy pie and really solid nutrition, of course, you know, we're all practitioners. Some regular acupuncture sessions can be particularly helpful. And you could even add laying on the table for acupuncture into your rest slice. I think it's a really great opportunity for some forced rest. As you know, when you have needles in your body, you have to lay very still and relax and breathe. And I think for some women, that's the only rest that they're getting, is when they're coming to see me for weekly acupuncture. So I let them know this is a good start, but you need to have something like in your day every single day to give you a bit of recharge. And what women often come back and tell me is, I'm feeling a lot less overwhelmed. I feel like my brain fog is a lot better. I'm sleeping better. I'm not wired and tired anymore. And I'm delegating what I need to my other family members or my partner. So acupuncture, of course. And then, yeah, some really targeted herbs and supplements to suit each individual for whatever they might be presenting with. And those would probably be my top four considerations when I'm seeing women postpartum during this time.
Yeah, that sounds fabulous. I love that. I love that pie chart analogy, and I'm glad you went into the like, sleep is not rest. You have to be conscious. even if you fall asleep on the acupuncture table, that I guess maybe that counts. But
absolutely, it counts.
Yeah, just getting your 7, 8, and 9 hours of sleep at night is just not enough for anybody. Like, we can't just be packed back to back all day every day, and it's especially true from for women who have just been through something as incredible and taxing as growing a whole human being in space of 9 months and then bringing it into the world. I guess I'd love to know a little bit more about what kind of, like, do you redo like another blood test after birth? And then are you looking for specific markers in there? And what is it that's different about a quote unquote normal blood test, or like what are you tracking for in a blood test in a woman who's over 35 versus under 35 that might kind of give you some clues that she's going to need a little bit of extra support and that her journey might be different?
Yeah. So oftentimes when women first come to see me in clinic, I'm sort of operating with what they've already got. They might have their 6-week blood tests that they get at their 6-week checkup. So they might bring those in with me for me. And I'll go ahead and look at things like their iron levels, which, of course, you know, looking at an iron studies postpartum, most women are depleted. I'm looking at things like zinc and B12, DHEA to sort of discover what's happening with the adrenal health state. I'm looking at, I can honestly say that I don't look at hormone panels when someone's early postpartum, because I kind of know what to expect there. And, you know, I might look at things like inflammatory markers in some cases, like your CRP and your ESR as needed. If someone's coming in that presents with something a bit more inflammatory, sometimes we're looking at their autoimmune state to see what's happening there, especially with their women who end up with autoimmune thyroiditis, or postnatal like Hashimoto's. And so we'll look at a full thyroid panel and that sort of thing. And as far as the over 35 versus the younger cohort under 35, I would say as far as like your early postnatal bloods go, it's pretty standard across the board. I'm not looking at hormones necessarily at this stage, just because it is a snapshot in time and we can pretty much assume that the hormones are going to be on the low side. So your estrogen, your progesterone, your prolactin is probably going to be elevated, especially if you're breastfeeding. But like, let's say, for example, I get some blood tests back for a woman who's 3 months into her postpartum and we get a very low reading of DHEA. I'm going to assume that that is probably very likely that she's in the adrenal fatigue category, I put that in quotations, and or, for example, looking at some of her electrolytes and just her general blood count, we might see some low sodium, maybe some low potassium there. So then we'd be working to improve those as well and putting that through a Chinese medicine lens, of course. So I really just use the blood tests as something to guide me, but I really lean on my TCM pattern recognition here.
And what does that look like through a TCM lens? What kind of things do you see most commonly? And is there a big difference in the patterns that people present, that women present with over 35 versus under 35 in your experience?
Yeah, definitely. I think this is where I start to see a lot of women are drawing on their Jing reserves. And then that's where I'm starting to notice that like really deep, like yang deficiency or yin deficiency or some combination of both, like that kidney and yin and yang deficiency can be present. And I find it can really kind of go in either direction. So you might get someone who's like hot and dry, or you might get someone who's more like cold and fluidy. So you've got maybe someone who's swinging into more of like a yang cold sort of pattern. That might be your like hypothyroid patients or your Hashimoto's patients. And then your hot and dry people might be your like extreme yin and blood deficiency, your liver and kidney yin deficiency, where they're getting night sweats way well past their 6 week mark. And they're starting to, you know, getting a little bit hot and dry. For example, maybe they're noticing some vaginal dryness, or they're noticing that they're just getting hot flushes past when, you know, in the early stages of postpartum, where that's quite common for everyone across the board, including women in their 20s who are postpartum as well. You know, that initial 6 weeks, it's pretty common to have, to be hot at night and to have night sweats and things like that, just due to the sudden hormone drop postpartum. But for women over 35, often this will keep going past that 6 week mark. So that's something that I might notice, sort of if someone is over 35, with that in mind.
What are some of the things that you see that are really common postpartum that we normalize in society that potentially we shouldn't be normalizing?
Yeah, I think definitely a level of anxiety. I think a level of overwhelm and just feeling really spun out. And I think, you know, it gets chalked up to like, oh, this is just a crazy time postpartum and, you know, it's going to be so hectic and you're going to feel pulled in all sorts of different directions, but that's just motherhood. That's just part of the deal. You're going to feel like crap. You're going to feel overwhelmed. You're going to feel stressed. You're going to feel anxious. And, you know, that's sort of touted as like, that's just part of motherhood and you'll get used to it. It will get easier. And just to kind of grin and bear it. And I know personally, when I went to my doctor and told her what I was experiencing postpartum, and that was definitely part of it, she was like, this is just part of early motherhood and you're just finding your feet and you'll be fine. And that was it.
Yeah, I can definitely resonate with that. My second child was a terrible sleeper and basically didn't sleep for more than about an hour at a time and was not interested in having bottles at all. So exclusively breastfed, not sleeping. And that's a recipe for disaster, right? Because as a mother, if you're getting sleep in 45 minute blocks, like that takes a real toll on mental health very quickly. And I remember going to see my GP to get a referral for sleep school. And I'd spoken to a friend beforehand, both of you know this person, and she said, "You always seem so really put together and so on top of things, you have to cry in this appointment. Otherwise, you're not going to get the referral." And I couldn't cry. And he nearly wouldn't give me the referral. He's like, "Well, you know, like babies, you can't expect your baby to sleep through the night." And I was trying to explain what, you know, the reality was of being so sleep deprived. And I really had to push. I ended up saying, "I'm not leaving without a referral." I said the people at the, you know, the people at sleep school can assess my eligibility for the program. And as it turned out, they called me and they said, "Oh, honey, you are coming for our 7-day program. Like there is no day program or weekend program like these, you know, these mini versions." Like I was there for a full week, 28 other zombie mums walked in on that first day and we all walked out with at least 2 full nights of sleep. But, you know, like that level of normalizing what for some women is really significant pathology, it's such a disservice. It is such a disservice because that type of experience is going to potentially prevent a couple from wanting to, or, you know, or prevent the desire for future pregnancies and for future children. There's, I know I can think of at least a handful of people that I've come across who just had such a horrible time with their first. They just went, "You know what, we're done. We always wanted to have more, but we're good. We're not doing that again."
I can relate to that. I think it absolutely highlights the fact that there's not enough support for women postpartum, especially women over 35 who are experiencing a different postpartum than those in younger years. I don't think it's recognized, and I think that it's overlooked. And I think, you know, it's not noticed that women can possibly be going through 2 transitions at once. We could be going through postpartum, and then we can also be going through perimenopause, and how that might actually change and create more nuance within something that we've not maybe considered that can be happening at the same time, or how that might influence each transition. So something that I really think about is, you know, if you're breastfeeding, let's say 6 months down the track when baby gets food introduced and breastfeeding shifts and changes a little bit. This is absolutely when I noticed a big change in my mood and how my body was behaving, and really solidified to me that I was in fact early stages in perimenopause. And that was when I hit the six month mark and my daughter started eating solid food. My breastfeeding declined a little bit just as a result. And I started to notice that my sleep went askew. I had a really hard time falling asleep. I had a hard time staying asleep after I'd get up to breastfeed once in the night. and that really wore me down. And I saw doctors and really tried to get on top of everything, just knowing what I know and having the background that I do. I was like, I need to figure out why this is happening. And it took me some time to figure out, you know, why this was the case, and what I had been catapulted into was that early perimenopause. But, you know, when you're 6 months postpartum, you are still postpartum, but you can also be experiencing this other transition at the same time. So I think as far as women being recognized by their providers to be going through these sorts of things, I don't think it is recognized. I think it's highly overlooked. I think it's dismissed, or it's justified in other ways.
Yeah, and I guess if you piece together all of these symptoms that women are supposed to be sucking it up, so to speak, postpartum, it's like your hair's going to fall out, your pelvic floor is going to be shot, you're not going to be sleeping, you're going to be a nervous wreck, potentially you're going to be crying all the time, your breast milk may or may not come in and all of it's normal. You're probably going to get mastitis, you know, like there's so many of these things that are just expected almost. And I think it's so, it's a real disservice. Is, I mean, it's just the best phrase I could think of. But, you know, if we think about all of the nutrition that's needed to support recovery, to support, you know, if breastfeeding is happening, then to be able to produce breast milk, which is essentially the same as doing a blood transfer, like as donating blood every day with the amount of milk that's produced. It's, you know, the caloric requirements, it's well in excess of 3,000 calories a day. And the, for a lot of women, their barrier is their appetite. They just aren't hungry enough. You know, their spleen she is so depleted from the pregnancy, they just can't get the food in. They can't get the nutrition in. And if you're not getting protein, you're not, as you were saying before, you're not getting all of your vitamins and minerals. If you're not able to eat your fruit and veg, you know, like it's 1,800 calories doesn't fuel an adult that is breastfeeding and potentially even recovering from surgery if there's been a C-section. You know, throw sleep deprivation into the mix. It's a recipe for disaster. And there's so many of these, you know, get your body back and bounce back programs where, you know, women are encouraged to be on these 1,200 calorie diets or 1,000 calorie diets.
Yeah, lose the baby weight, get on it. I can't even tell you how many women I've seen in this last year who come to me postpartum and they are struggling to breastfeed, their breast milk supply has dropped, they're probably like 4 to 6 months in and they're wanting to lose weight. And when we actually unpack it and look at what they're not eating nearly enough and they're trying to breastfeed and they're struggling with breast milk production and doing additional pumping to try and build up their supply because that's what their practitioner, their general practitioner has told them. And I'm telling them you're not actually eating enough food to produce milk for your baby right now. And weight loss just shouldn't be in your head. Like this is just not where this part of the journey is for you. We really need to focus on getting you rebuilt again. And if your desire is to continue breastfeeding, then you need to be eating a lot more than what you're eating now. So then, yeah, as you said, we're working on their spleen chi so that they've got that appetite back. And then once they are eating enough protein and enough of all the other bits and bobs, they start to feel a lot better and their breast milk picks up. They sleep a lot better. They just feel like they've got a lot more gas in the tank and they're able to handle the day-to-day, especially when they've got more than one kid. It's just very taxing, as you know.
What do you actually say to, because I imagine it sounds like there's a lot of like conflicting or potentially conflicting desires and expectations that are loaded into someone who's coming to you with a situation like that, right? Where they're trying to lose weight and trying to breastfeed and trying to do that on 1,000 calories a day, which just sounds ludicrous to me. Like I have no idea how you would get out of bed on that, to be honest, let alone the rest of it. How do you actually have that conversation with someone, particularly if they're really fixated on the, or like really caught up in the personal and societal expectations of what this quote unquote should look like and should be like? How do you support them through that process?
Well, I think I'm really blunt initially, and I basically explained to them why weight loss is not, there's no place for that right at this current moment. At the moment, we need to nourish you so that you can keep nourishing yourself and your baby. And I give them some education around why that's important. I talk about protein. I talk about blood sugar levels. I talk about energy and how that all translates. I talk about breast milk production. So I give them all this information so that they can truly make the decision for themselves. But I definitely am blunt initially. And I really try to support them in knowing that they will find their way back to their body and connect with themselves in that way again. But at the current moment, that's not going to happen unless we get you feeling more, get more energy, feeling more grounded, feeling more capable, feeling more resilient. And then in some time, you can look at getting back to exercise, exercising the way that you like to, and, you know, way down the track, look at what weight loss might look like, if that's even necessary, because a lot of times, you know, if you're eating well, eating enough, you know, your metabolism should follow suit. I often will explain Johnson's survival switch. It's where if you are under eating, then your body kind of like flicks the switch into starvation mode, and it will actually just kind of hold on, rather than having a more balanced metabolism where you're not, you know, holding on to weight, in those cases. So yeah, I talk a lot about how nourishing and supporting your body will lead to weight loss down the track, when that time is meant to happen. And that, yeah, nourishment is the most important thing first and foremost.
Yeah, I think it does tend to go in one of two directions, that women find that their weight either falls off when they're breastfeeding, or they don't lose a single kilogram until after they've finished breastfeeding, presumably when their nutritional intake is a closer match for their needs. It's like the body's holding on to that extra body fat as a protective mechanism against the undernourishment. Most of the time it's unintentional. I think there's so much unbrainwashing that needs to happen in clinic because of all of the information that people are getting from well-meaning friends and family and from the information that they're finding online. So much of it is unhelpful and incorrect for where they are in their health journey.
Absolutely. I mean, we only have to scroll for like about 2 seconds on Instagram before you find an influencer who's, you know, this healthy looking, muscly, thin looking woman postpartum, and she's got like 5 kids, and people think, oh, I can have that too if I follow this program or I do this thing. And I just don't think it's just really not worth comparing yourself to anyone online, especially when you're postpartum. It's such a raw time that we really just need to be turning inward and connecting with ourselves and our baby and our family to ensure that you're feeling safe and held. And that is a recipe for a good metabolism and a good healthy mind and a strong body and solid sleep.
So what are your favorite treatments for the postpartum phase? Do you split it for like that early postpartum phase and more of that later phase? Do you do anything particularly different if breastfeeding is happening or not? What does that look like for you and your patients?
Yeah, definitely. I think early postpartum, it's a lot about sort of nourishing the mother again, getting that breast milk production firing on all cylinders. So I'm really assessing the woman when she comes in that first 6 weeks. You know, I'm just assessing the state of her yin and blood. And we're talking a lot about her birth story and managing things there. So if there is some birth trauma, we might look at, you know, maybe we're building some resources first. I might just focus literally on tonifying yin and blood in that time. For some women, I might get in there and use a lot of rice grain moxa if that's appropriate. If they're a bit more hot and dry, probably be aiming just more for acupuncture and maybe some light heat lamp use. But just keeping them really like nourished and building that yin and blood pretty much for everybody. And then for each individual, let's say I have a woman who's having trouble breastfeeding in the early days, there might be some calming shen around that as well. I find breastfeeding can be, it's such a steep learning curve, especially your first time breastfeeding. So sometimes it's literally calming shen and unpacking the breastfeeding journey up to that point and providing some reassurance. The conversation is huge. Like, yes, the treatments are important, but I find the connection and the conversation to be a huge part of the treatment as well. And just the supportive nature of the environment that I try to create for my patients. Like, you can come tell me anything. How are you going? Are you anxious? What's happening? And unpacking that. And that in and of itself just really seems to help kind of calm everything down. And then sort of as we move through that, the treatments within the first 6 weeks, if I do find someone is having a hard time dealing with their birth trauma or they're holding on to some things towards the end of their pregnancy, then we might do something like a low treatment if it's suitable and if they've got the resources to do so. But I do find a lot of my low treatments, if there is anything to be done, come in usually around the 6-month mark. where I feel like a second recalibration is happening. Sort of like for me, where, you know, my breastfeeding started to shift, and that's when I really started to notice, you know, changes in my mood and my sleep. And I found low treatments to be really helpful for me here. And then I would say, you know, even further along in the year, we're just sort of addressing anything that comes up. You know, the return of the period, things can be a little bit rocky as the hormones sort of find their grooves again. So we might be doing some work on regulating the cycle or managing heavy bleeding, or maybe there's some pelvic pain sneaking in again for my girls with endometriosis, in which case I really love Tung acupuncture for pelvic pain in these cases. So I'm a real mixed bag. I sort of have a tool belt of things that I like to use, but I would say initially, and you know, the whole way along, always, always, always supporting the resources that women need, you know, your yin, your blood, your jing, your yang, everything. We're just assessing what comes into the room on the day and supporting where we need to.
Nice. And what are your favorite herbal formulas?
I would say I do love a Gui Pi Tang early and postpartum. I think it's really quite nice for the heart blood. I remember really early in my postpartum, you saying to me that all mothers are heart blood deficient to some degree. And I have found that to be very true because, of course, we're worrying about our children. We're thinking about them all the time. We're literally giving them our heart blood. So I really like Gui Pi Tang for that. For some women who come in who are a bit more hot and dry, I would say something like a Gui Shao Di Hang Wan or a Lu Wei Di Hang Wan might be suitable for them. But keeping in with the yin and blood nourishing kind of always. For my gals who are struggling with hypothyroidism or Hashis, I might do like a mix of like Yogui Wan. And if we are finding that there's an exacerbation of their thyroid antibodies, then I might lean on something like the pre and post womb goo from Alchemy, quite like those. And, you know, for my gals who might be having trouble sleeping later on in time, especially around that 6 month mark where insomnia might start to sneak in, and if they might be a Anshin Ding Zhuan presentation or a Tianwen Bu Shin Dan, or maybe even just a plain old Gui Pi Tang modified. Off the top of my head, that's about all the formulas I can think of, but I'm always, you know, assessing and changing things as people come in.
I remember explaining the Gui Pi Tang thing to a patient once. They were like, why? Like, they were trying to understand why they were having trouble sleeping and what the blood thing had to do with it. And so I gave them a little rundown. It's like, at the moment, it's like you're trying to sleep on a bed with no mattress.
I love that.
The mattress.
That's a great analogy.
Jack has the best analogies. Honestly, I can't remember what was the one you gave me the other day. It was actually so good. Oh, well, about Shui Fu Zhiyu Tang. I was like, why does Shui Fu Zhiyu Tang work well for insomnia? And he was like, imagine trying to sleep in your bed with a bunch of stuff around you. Like, you just can't get comfortable because there's something in your way at all times. That's why Shui Fu Zhiyu Tang works for insomnia. And I was like, gosh, I love that.
A bed full of teddies and pillows.
Yeah, exactly. I guess one formula I forgot to mention that I use a lot for postpartum in conjunction with other formulas is Bazantang. Can't go wrong, really. You're supporting the spleen, you're building blood. I mean, I think it's a pretty simple formula, but gosh, they've been around for thousands of years. They must be good for something, right?
100%. 100%. And I like that you have also noticed the heart blood deficiency being such a common feature. And I think, you know, if we consider the Baomai connection that really governs pregnancy, and essentially that's severed in a matter of moments, or, you know, in a matter of hours, that connection that's been very well established throughout the whole pregnancy, it really does leave a gap for mum that needs to be addressed in one way or another. So I like Gui Pi Tang as kind of like the, you know, give me a reason not to use Gui Pi Tang, And then maybe there'll be other formulas that I'll give in addition. But I like that you're using it a lot as well. It's good to see that you're getting great results with that.
Absolutely.
What about supplements?
Okay, supplement-wise, I made a list of supplements to talk to you guys about. And there's some that I've played around with myself and found some great benefits. So I thought I would highlight those in particular. And I'm maybe going to highlight some of the less obvious ones. Like, of course, iron is probably suitable for a lot of women. B12, really looking at some of the minerals. Magnesium would be at the top of my list. So I love magnesium postpartum for a lot of reasons. I think it's fabulous for sleep. It's really great for, you know, supporting muscles and drawing water into the gut to keep the bowels moving. And it's just got that really nice calming effect, especially magnesium glycinate, which is probably the one I use the most. You know, there's 3 and 8, which has a bit more effect on the brain. So maybe better for moms with brain fog and anxiety, but probably oscillating between those two and glycinate is what I use the most in clinic. So I pretty much have all of my postpartum moms on magnesium. Creatine. I quite love creatine at the moment. I think it's great for preserving and building muscle, which, as you know, during pregnancy, you're going to lose a bit of muscle, especially on your bum and your glutes. So I think in rebuilding muscle when the time comes, creatine is phenomenal. And it's also so good for the brain. It's great for focus and so good for sleep deprivation. And gosh, I wish I knew about it earlier in my postpartum, but I've probably started integrating it more in now. And I notice a huge difference in how my brain is functioning. And with brain fog, it's so, so good. So definitely magnesium and creatine. And then I'd be looking at something like choline and EPA, so, or even just choline on its own. So choline is something that definitely is depleted through pregnancy and postpartum. It's great for baby. It's great for their brain and spinal cord production, but also for women and helping with brain focus and attention. So, and, you know, is further depleted during breastfeeding as well. So I think it's something that is really suitable to add in early and postpartum for breastfeeding purposes for baby and for mother. Because I think, you know, one thing that we talk a lot about postpartum is baby brain and what wonderful things to add in to assist with focus and just helping us to stay more mentally acute. I would say choline, EPA, and creatine would be my top three. And then staying on a multivitamin, I think in your postpartum is super important as well. We're probably going to end up with a bunch of nutrient deficiencies postpartum, just with pregnancy and so on, that I think having a multivitamin just on the go at all times is going to be just a helpful adjunct, you know, for when your diet might not be great some days because you do get busy and things aren't always perfect. A multivitamin will be there for you. And then of course, calcium, because we talked about how, you know, bone density is decreasing, during pregnancy, postpartum, and then especially over the age of 35, where, you know, maybe our estrogen levels for some women are down at a lower level. And so our bones aren't as dense as they once, have been. And, you know, this is where I would be thinking ahead to prevent osteopenia and osteoporosis later in life. And I'd be giving women, and I do give women, calcium, usually calcium and magnesium together is an easy one. So that'd probably be my top supplements. I'm sure I'm missing some, but that would be my main ones.
I know you recommended like adrenal cortex when I've talked to you about some of my patients who are like low on the DHEA and potentially burning through a lot of cortisol and things like that. Is that something you include for postpartum, or is that so, or do you play that a bit more cautiously and wait to see what happens and see if that's something that regulates itself?
I would say that I'm definitely supporting adrenal function with all of my patients, and I absolutely love adrenal cortex. I actually joke, I'm like, this is the key to all of my power when I recommend women buy that for themselves, as it is something that you can purchase online on iHerb. It is a North American product from a brand called Thorne, and I absolutely love it. It just, I really feel like it gives me that little bit of extra oomph for the day, a little bit of extra abundance. But it is going to help to support adrenal function, which I think is going to be drawn on, of course, postpartum anyways, just with waking up through the night, but also over 35 as well. We just have a little bit more pressure on our adrenals as is. But you can really do that with a lot of different products, not just adrenal cortex. Of course, you could support that herbally in other ways. I don't know if I was allowed to mention adrenal cortex. Sorry about that.
Absolutely, you are.
Okay, great. I wasn't sure because I know it's like an, you know, a TGA funny one. So,
yeah.
I had no idea. So,
that's all good. You can always edit it out if you need to. I was like, oh, I don't know if I should just say that people can order it on iHerb.
Yeah, well, I was actually just going to say we'll put the link to the iHerb product in the show notes in case anyone's curious to see the exact product. I think it's a great product. I've used it a lot over the years. I'm leaning more towards using deer velvet these days as a first port of call, and then adrenal cortex for those who don't do as well on the deer velvet. But fabulous products, especially in that early stages of treatment where nutrition still isn't optimized and you just need to really support energy so that they can get through the day and function.
Yeah, I also love deer velvet. I do find it too heating for some people. For a time, I was taking deer velvet when I was seeing Claire, and I did find it to be, after time, to be a bit too hot for me. But I do have women take deer velvet and they do really well on it. I find it especially great for hypothyroid patients, for my hypothyroid postpartum mamas. It's amazing.
Yeah. And I think you, keeping an eye on the status of yin and fluids really helps to guide that decision as to which one you would choose for your patient.
Absolutely.
I have like another question that's a little bit of a tangent for you, Andrea. I know that you do a bit of work with, like quite a bit of work with like vaginal microbiome stuff. I'm just curious, have you noticed any connection between like vaginal dysbiosis and rougher postpartum experiences? And if so, what are they?
I love this question, Jack. Yes, absolutely. I'll start with kind of what I generally see as far as vaginal health is concerned postpartum for women over the age of 35. We'll keep it specific. So vaginal dryness, probably number one. So when you're postpartum initially, of course, because you've got that massive hormone drop, your estrogen is very low. And if you're breastfeeding, it will probably stay quite low. And so a lot of women experience vaginal dryness in this time, especially if they initially already had quite low circulating estrogen levels, and maybe they were already experiencing some painful intercourse or some vaginal dryness prior to falling pregnant. This is where I would see vaginal dryness really becoming an issue, is when women become sexually active again and they find it very painful, and they just can't. And they might, you know, it might be 3 months on when they do finally have sex, and they report feeling very uncomfortable and unable to do it. So this is definitely, that's definitely something that I see in clinic quite frequently. And there's tons we can do here. And then as far as the actual microbiome is concerned, because estrogen is on the low side, we'll see a decline in lactobacillus population. One of their sort of, you know, regulating factors is estrogen. And when estrogen declines, that's when our lactobacillus population declines as well. So as far as dysbiosis is concerned, it's a time for microbes to proliferate because we don't have that environmental control that lactobacillus offers. So we could see an increase of things like bacterial vaginosis, which is probably one of your more common ones. But you can get other microbes as well. There's lots of, you know, we've got aerobic vaginitis that can present itself, which can be quite painful and inflammatory. So I would say I probably do see quite a few women who present with BV and other bacterial infections, and that might translate as, you know, smelly discharge or just increased discharge in general or painful intercourse. And then also just not recovering very well from episiotomies and from tears. Because when estrogen is on the low side as well, the vaginal tissue doesn't heal as well. So, you know, you see that in menopause where women have, you know, vaginal tears and things like that because of the declining estrogen levels. So that's definitely something that I see as well. And oftentimes these women can really benefit from some local estrogen therapies that they can arrange that through their doctor, and that can just help them with the additional healing. But Chinese medicine is amazing here as well. And there's some great supplements that I use in clinic too, things like sea buckthorn oil, which you can use topically and taken orally as well to kind of like plump up the vaginal tissues. So that can be really effective on its own and often is a first port of call before I'll even recommend a woman goes to their GP to speak about estrogen therapy. Often we'll try some oral sea buckthorn oil, and then if they're healed enough, we can be using it vaginally as well. You can use intravaginal application of sea buckthorn oil, and I think it's great. It really provides a lot of relief for so many women, and there's so many other products out there as well, but that's probably the one I use the most of with that in mind. And we can even use things like vaginal pessaries, which are becoming more popular, and there's a few out on the market now, to increase lactobacillus population vaginally, and that can be really helpful as well before going down the antibiotics route if needed. So yeah, I love vaginal healthcare. It's amazing. Honestly, I think it's not really spoken about so readily, and it's definitely something that postpartum, I definitely noticed changes there, and I had no idea what was going on. And that really spurred me to dive deeper into the vaginal microbiome so I could learn what was going on with myself. And now I can apply it to my patients. So yeah, I think it's really important.
That's so interesting. It's it reminds me of a talk at the first IICMC in 2019 by Brandon Horn, and he talked a lot about the vaginal microbiome and also the uterine microbiome. And he said, well, his opinion was that there's a lot of overlap between yin deficiency symptoms, kidney yin deficiency symptoms, and that reduction in lactobacillus diversity and population numbers. And he had found in his clinical practice, and it really resonated with what I'd also seen in clinical practice, that a simple Jibai Dihuang, for example, is so great as a starting point for the vaginal microbiome and for all of that genitourinary health, whether it's recurrent thrush or, you know, recurrent BV or anything that's kind of going on in there. It's a good baseline formula and maybe some branch formulas to add on to that. Is that what you're seeing as well in your patients? Do you use that formula a lot, or are you more going with the, like, you find the sea buckthorn is more effective and you don't need the...
I usually use both. So yeah, absolutely. As far as formulas are concerned, Jibai Dihuangwan, absolutely. I use that one probably the most. But then as well, I've actually been using the pre and post womb formulas for BV, and I've had great success there using those alongside a constitutional formula. So I would say, you know, as far and ureaplasma and mycoplasma would be the other ones that I'm using pre and post for. And I found that to be super effective. In addition, I do have some extra training. I did a course with Moira Bradford. She's a naturopath who's a PhD who does different vaginal microbiome research, mostly on thrush, but I think she does a bunch of other things as well. And when I took her course, it really opened my eyes to all the different things that we can do to support women's vaginal health, including some vaginal irrigations, things that we're actually taking straight to the vaginal microbiome itself, because taking something orally and putting it into the gut is different than putting it into the vagina. They're two different microbiome sites, and absolutely one influences the other, and things that you take in orally will absolutely affect your vaginal health for sure. But to really expedite the process, I find local treatment, as in inserting things like pessaries and sea buckthorn oil and other irrigations to help with acidity and for environmental control, is so helpful and just really expedites the process, just gets you there a bit quicker.
And what do you recommend in terms of lubrication? Because if there is that dryness and they're wanting to resume intercourse, there's kind of like that double-edged sword where the lubricant is obviously going to provide some comfort during intimacy, but then so many of the compounds, even in the natural products, are going to further disrupt that imbalance with the microbiome. What do you recommend for your patients?
Yeah, I really love the olive and bee. It's like an ointment kind of, but once it heats up, it can be quite slick. So that can be really great. It's very neutral. It's something that women can use, especially if they find their dryness to be quite painful. So you could literally use that as a lubricant. I don't typically recommend sea buckthorn as a lubricant because it is bright orange and it is quite messy. But there are some great, really neutral, fragrance-free and minimal ingredients, no preservatives, lubricants on the market. So that's probably what I would be aiming for, is a non-preservative lubricant that, you know, isn't water-based necessarily, because that actually can grow bacteria in it. We don't want to contribute to a vaginal microbiome that's already struggling. So that's probably what I would aim for. I don't have any specific brands on the top of my head, but I do just give my patients sort of like a guideline to look for. I'm like, look for non-water-based, look for non-preservatives, and play with what suits your body best. But Olive and Bee is a great first port of call. It's well tolerated by most people and works really well.
I will plug Fiona's bioherbology brand. She makes a product called Dewy Fruit, which is absolutely amazing for vaginal health. It is oil-based, so the only concern there is it's not compatible with condoms, and so birth control is something that needs to be front of mind if you're not in that phase of ready to have a subsequent pregnancy happen. But we'll link to that as well. Fiona is the co-founder of Heavenly Chi, and we very much support that product. It's amazing. So you can grab that from her website. If you're in the US, I think they sell it through Larsa or Golden Needle. There's lots of places you can get it.
I do recommend Dewy Fruit to my patients as well. And I think we actually had it on the shelf for a little while as well. But it is great. And I've had lots of good reviews from my patients as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it has. It's a cacao butter base, and it has some Chinese herbal extracts. I believe it's a spiguric extract of dungguay and potentially a couple of other things in there as well, but it's a good, it's well formulated. She's put a lot of thought and research into that product. So yeah.
Love it.
Awesome. Is there anything else that you feel called to share with us today before we wrap up?
I might take a crack at talking about autoimmune flares postpartum. Maybe just like a little, what do you think? Do you guys want to know about that?
Yeah,
we want to know about that.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want me to just jump in with my personal experience and sort of how that led me to look deeper into it?
Yeah.
Okay.
However, cool. You would like to share it.
All right. Well, about 6 months postpartum for me, when I was sort of semi-weaning my daughter, I suppose, as she started having solids, I started to notice that my psoriasis was coming back with a vengeance. I've had psoriasis since I was in my teens, but it's never really been bad and it's always been managed quite well. And when I was about 6 months postpartum, I started to notice it all over my arms and legs and just growing and growing and growing. And with really no warning, and at the same time getting some joint pain. And I thought, what is happening here and why is this happening? Because I wasn't drinking any alcohol. I was, you know, fairly healthy and clean, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And then as I started to look deeper into why this might be happening at this stage of my postpartum, what I discovered was, as my prolactin levels started to decline a little bit, or even just fluctuate as my daughter was introducing solids, what I started to understand and look into was that this is where the balance between the TH1 and the TH2 dominance in our immune system starts to change a little bit. While we're pregnant and while we're early breastfeeding, we're more TH2 dominant. So that's like your peacekeeping immune cells. And then as soon as, you know, less prolactin was being made, perhaps, and things started to become a little bit more normal for me, TH1 started to come back more into the picture. And they are kind of like a seesaw, and they, you know, they're utilized for different things, but your TH1 sort of like your fighter, that's your yang. It's going to be your heat. And I started to notice that that maybe was influencing the current situation where my psoriasis was flaring. So when I put this into a TCM lens, what I sort of thought about it as is because I was severely lacking in yin and blood at the time, that this presentation of this unchecked yang and heat was presenting in my skin. And it really got me thinking about women who have autoimmune conditions and when they start to flare and when we start to notice signs and symptoms, is probably somewhere between that 4 and 6 months postpartum mark. And why that might be, could be that, you know, if you already have an autoimmune condition and then the influences that have kept your body in that TH2 dominant state, whether it's breastfeeding, pregnancy, and so on, as soon as that starts to lift, then this, you know, if there's not enough yin and blood to kind of anchor that yang, that's when that starts to flare up and become imbalanced.
And I think for so many parents, that 6 month mark is a real defining time, because the unrelenting parental interface starts to come into focus, because baby's starting to sleep less and less, but the exhaustion is building, and potentially as you're dropping feeds, that the output of that constant output of blood on a daily basis, you're not quite so depleted. And so now your body's got a little bit more resources to be able to generate some heat and generate some yang and, you know, start to speak and voice its opinion to say, hey, we are really pissed off about this. We need better circumstances here. We need better living conditions. Please sort it out.
Absolutely. And for me, it was like, at that time is probably when I found my way into your rooms, Claire, and I was having all sorts of crazy immune system stuff going on, and I'd had such a lovely reprieve from any autoimmune symptoms for so long from being pregnant that it was really just coming back with such a vengeance that I was like, what is happening? And then when I actually look at what I was doing lifestyle-wise from a Yangsheng perspective, even, I was doing everything. I wasn't delegating. I wasn't asking for help. I was doing everything. I was so fixated on everything to do with my daughter's care that I was doing it all myself. And me and my husband being first time parents, you know, he was doing everything he thought was supportive and helpful. And, you know, we were just kind of doing it and rolling along. And then I realized, oh my gosh, I actually am doing everything and I need to pass over some of this to you. And so began the delegation and the equal care of our daughter. And, you know, that took some time and some conversations, but, you know, I got to a better place in the end. But I think, you know, when I look at women who get things like Hashimoto's postpartum as well, I wonder, you know, is this the result of, you know, things starting as not a lot of resources, nothing to really buffer or to sort of protect. And that with these lack of resources, you know, things are able to sort of penetrate into the deeper layers. So into the divergent channels, perhaps, and maybe this is where we're seeing autoimmune presentations take place, just because of that lack of resources, that lack of like fluids and yin and blood and all the things that create this beautiful buffer to sort of prevent these, you know, outer influences making their way into our system, whether it's emotional trauma, birth trauma, or, you know, just a lot of stress at all times.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of, you know, that prolonged depletion is for some women, if they're ending up in that autoimmune presentation, that they've migrated or been downgraded to a, you know, maybe down to the fourth or the fifth divergent channel where they're really just running on fumes and, you know, that profound depletion, you know, which is the recipe for any thyroid condition, is just be profoundly depleted for a long period of time and you'll end up with a thyroid problem most of the time. And yeah, once you've got that pathogenic heat that's coming into the picture as well, it can create a lot of havoc.
This is why I really like using low treatments early on, is I feel like if we can at least relieve some of the burden, that can be a really effective first line of defense. But then also potentially early in postpartum, doing a divergent treatment that's a DSD. So as opposed to like trying to draw out the pathogen, we're actually just trying to be like, actually, you just stay down in those deeper levels. We're going to build up these resources first. And then once you're into a place where you can be you've got more strength to move this pathogen on out, then we can start doing SDS and like pulling that out down the track when women are feeling more supported and resourced.
Yeah, and I really like using consolidated dimye treatments when there's that, you know, that really severe depletion, and just especially when there's things happening in the pelvic area, whether it's postpartum or other reproductive issues. I think it's a really nourishing treatment, especially if someone might not be quite ready for a low treatment.
Yes, absolutely. I suppose with lows, it can be drawing on that blood resource. And if it's not quite there, it could be quite depleting.
Yeah. I think, you know, there are some different ideas on low treatments and whether it's applicable for someone with profound blood deficiency. There are some times where I've done low treatments on people with significant blood deficiency, especially if there's a lot of visible lows and a lot of that blood is actually just trapped in the wrong spot and not available. But I probably approach it with a bit more judiciously, and I view the treatment as more of an invitation rather than I'm here to bleed you. I'm asking the body, hey, have you got any leftover garbage that you would like to get rid of today? And just kind of do it like that. And if the body wants to release a single pinhead drop of blood or whether there's more that wants to come out, I find that that's a fairly respectful way of doing it with someone who's depleted.
Yeah, I think so. And I always think about Sharon Weisenbaum. Granted, this is from a herbal perspective, but she talks about crappy blood. And how you can't, it's hard to build really good blood when there's a lot of stagnant blood hanging around. So I kind of think about lows in that way. I'm not sure if that's like transferable, but I do often think about it like that.
I always think about herbal medicine from an acupuncture perspective or acupuncture from a herbal perspective. And yeah, I would agree that the, you know, the visible lows is the representation of that crappy blood. Yeah.
Yeah. Like when you're pregnant, you can get tons of like capillaries and visible capillaries showing up on your legs and that sort of thing. And for women who get like varicose veins and that sort of thing, would you consider women who have a lot of those kind of lows to be a good candidate for a low treatment postpartum?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. If I'm seeing them during pregnancy, I'll be doing low treatments during the pregnancy, especially because, you know, if there's significant varicose veins on the lower legs, there's a much greater increased risk of vulval varicosities as well, which is really, really uncomfortable, can be quite painful. And just that overall clinical picture, they're at increased risk of postpartum hemorrhage and other types of complications. So I'm always wanting to get stuck into those as early as they show up.
you typically hit the liver low for vulvar viscosities?
Just whatever's presenting. I do low treatments pretty much just based on visual. So whichever channel is affected, it's usually either the liver or the spleen channel, sometimes the stomach channel.
Yeah.
But I tend to try and balance with a yin and yang channel. I try not to exclusively do yin channels only just because they tend to be a lot more emotionally agitating for people, whereas I find if there's a yin and yang channel in any given low treatment, that any emotional response is not going to be as heightened or uncomfortable for the patient. I see the uncomfortable emotional reactions come more so with the yin channels, when the yin channels are used exclusively.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow, we've been around the world of postpartum and women's health. What a great discussion. Thank you so much for coming on, Andrea.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so much fun chatting with you guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for giving up your time on a Sunday and agreeing to come and have a chat with us.
My absolute pleasure. It's kind of a full circle moment because I've been listening to Heavenly Chi podcast since I first moved to Australia and got into the industry here and listened to a lot of my mentors and people that I really highly respect. So I feel very, very proud and very grateful to be featured. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, listeners, for your continued and ongoing support. Please remember to rate and share this episode so that it can reach other people. And if you liked this episode and there's anything you want to hear more of, please leave us your feedback. It all helps us to continue to bring you more amazing episodes of the Heavenly Chi podcast. Bye for now.